Downloads of the show are available at Podomatic.com or the Podomatic mobile app. Hey kids, you are listening to Radio Free Brooklyn, and this show is Fish Out of Agua with Michelle Carlo. Today is December 19, 2017. Yes, 2017 is coming to a close, but this song by the Steve Miller Band back in 1976 speaks to a lot of concerns a lot of people have going into the new year. Oof, 40 frickin' years have gone by and shite hasn't changed one little bit. Time keeps on slipping into the future. Time keeps slipping into the future. Oh, Lord, through the revolution. Yep, we're back with Fish Out of Agua on Radio Free Brooklyn. Yes, that was the Steve Miller Band with Fly Like an Eagle from the album Fly Like an Eagle from 1976. Yeah, isn't that crazy? Like, that song was, like, written more than 40 years ago, and it speaks to so many of the same concerns that we have today. I'm not going to get into the lyrics. You can Google them. You can listen to it again. But yeah, like I said before, 40 frickin' years have gone by, and like, what's changed? All right, maybe one or two things. But some things don't change, and we're going to continue. Some things like music don't change, and we're going to continue on the Wayback Machine with this song, chosen by this week's guest artist for her episode.
Sugar magnolia, blossoms blooming, heads all empty and I don't care.
Saw my baby down by the river,
knew she'd have to come up soon for air.
Sweet blossom, come on, under the willow, we can have high times if you look back. We can discover the wonders of nature,
rolling in the rushes down by the riverside. She's got everything we like for, she's got everything I need. Takes the wheel when I've seen double, pays my ticket when I speed.
She comes skimming through rays of violet, she can wait in a drop of dew. She don't come and I don't follow, waits backstage while I sing to you.
But she can dance a Cajun rhythm,
jump like a widow's in four-wheel drive.
She's a summer love in the spring, fall, and winter.
She can make happy any man alive. Sugar magnolia, ringing that bluebell, caught up in sunlight, going out singing, all walking in the sunshine. Come on, honey, come along with me.
She's got everything delightful, she's got everything I need. A breeze in the pines in the summer night, moonlight, crazy in the sunlight, yes indeed.
Sometimes when the cuckoo's crying, when the moon is halfway down, sometimes when the night is dying, I take me out and I wander around. I wander around.
Do, do, do.
The sunshine daydream.
And we're back with Fish Out of Agua on Radio Free Brooklyn. That was The Grateful Dead with Sugar Magnolia from their American Beauty album in 1970. Yeah, it's funny. Back when I was a kid, I used to see carved on the desks at school, because kids used to like carve what rock band they liked, and it would be like Led Zeppelin and Yes and The Who and Pink Floyd and Black Sabbath and Emerson, Lake and Palmer and a bunch of others. But The Grateful Dead wasn't really liked. I mean, I totally remember when I was in ninth grade seeing carved into the desk, "I'd be grateful if they were dead." It's funny, isn't it? I mean, I guess it was because the hippies were totally over by the time I was in high school. But you know what? Some of that sentiment still lives on. Maybe not in high schools. But as you will see, because now it's time for my favorite part of the show. Whoa, whoa.
Hey,
everybody. Welcome to Fish Out of Agua's Guest Artist of the Week. Woohoo! Woo. We're doing this in a different locale today, kids. Yes, on location with one of my favorite performers. Yes, I know. Every week I say the person's my favorite, but it's true. Everybody's my favorite. And I'm sitting right now in the warm and lovely kitchen of a woman who's accomplished and amazing and a fantastic storyteller and producer. And her name is Robin Beatty. Hi, Robin.
Hi, Michelle.
Oh, I'm so happy that you wanted to be on Fish Out of Agua. This is a real thrill for me to be interviewing you.
I feel honored.
So,
No, I did. I knew I had to wait.
So, let's get started. And this is a question that I ask everybody who's on the show. Where and how did we meet? Because I interview some people that I've known for over 20 years. I've interviewed some that I barely know for 20 weeks. And you and I fall someplace in the middle.
5 or 6 years ago, we met. I had been hearing about you.
You were?
Yeah.
Who was talking about me?
Well, HR Britain.
Oh, yes. HR Britain.
And HR, I was doing, at that point, my storytelling was, which was supporting me quite nicely, was all folk and fairy tales and literature and history. And I wanted to get into personal stories.
Mm.
And HR said, I think he had just moved to Boston. Yeah, I think it was when he moved to Boston.
Oh, then that he moved to Boston in early 2009. So it's that long ago. So that's almost 9 years ago.
Yeah. So,
wow.
But he started talking about you. I didn't meet you for a while, but he kept saying, if you want to do that, this is who you should get to know. This is who you, I think it was you and Sherry.
Oh, yeah, Sherry Weaver.
She says, you've got to meet her. You'll really like her. And we met because we both went to the United Solo show of Lawrence, whose name I now have forgotten, but you know I'm talking
Duddy.
About. Yes. No, not Duddy.
No,
that's his wife.
That's Lynn Duddy. Lawrence Howard.
Lawrence Howard. And I looked over and I just knew that was you.
You did? Oh, you probably had seen my picture or something.
No. I
really?
Just knew.
Really?
From sort of the way he described you. I hadn't seen a picture, but I just looked and I think I walked over and introduced myself.
Yes, I remember.
And you said to me the same thing, like, oh, I've heard about you.
Oh, my gosh. So I think HR Britain was, trying to set us up?
Yes.
Wow.
On a date.
Yes, on a date that's lasted for at least 6 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If not longer.
Yeah, I think Lawrence Howard was doing his Shackleton story.
Yes, Armchair
Adventure. Oh, my God. Lennon Lawrence, Portland Story Theater, you're getting a shout-out.
We love you.
Oh, my God, that is so cool. You know, one of the things that I really liked about you when I first met you, and I found it really, what I found really interesting, was that you made a living doing storytelling, mm-hmm. and which was the traditional type of storytelling. And the personal kind of storytelling wasn't really paying unless you did like a moth main stage show or something.
Unless you did a festival.
Which I had no idea existed yet. Wait, so I'm going to backtrack a little bit. So how did you meet HR?
He was, he took a class with a friend of mine.
Oh, okay.
And I was the director at that point of the Storytelling Center of New York City, which was all folk and fairy tales.
Okay, so it's not the personal storytelling that's going on today. It's the different kind.
Well, people do personal stories.
Did they do it back then?
Yeah. People have been doing personal stories for longer than the moth has been around.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
But is it only the moth that brought it to the forefront of people's consciousness?
I think the moth has better PR. And I think that the people who are doing, now I could be wrong. So if anybody's listening to this and I'm wrong, I'm sorry. But I think the moth really made an effort to reach out to people to get them to tell their stories. And in these other situations, it was more like festivals or people would do house concerts. and it would be, there's a performer doing it.
So they weren't reaching out to like the public. They were saying, come and do this.
Except they weren't saying, you can do this too. This is part of what you do.
So they were saying that we do this.
We do this.
And the moth was saying, you can do this.
Right. I think that's...
Oh.
No, I don't know if everybody would agree with that.
Okay.
But I often say things people don't agree with.
Well, no, because like when I first started doing the moth before, long before they blew up, in the aughts.
Right.
And
right.
Basically it was once a month at the New Eurekan. And sometimes Jennifer Hickson would say, there's only 8 names in this hat. Doesn't anybody else want to have a story? And sometimes she would tell a story. And sometimes Catherine Burns, the executive director, or the creative director, who would be there oftentimes, she would get up and tell a story. And that was my introduction to storytelling.
30 years ago, I had a friend who taught, well, she was teaching at the school I had graduated from, this acting school. And we were going to do a personal story. We were going to do a dialogue, a personal dialogue. I think that was my first thought about doing personal stories, but I couldn't figure out what I would talk about. And I'm sort of glad I waited. And listened, and learned from, you know, the folk and fairy tales and all those people, how to structure stories, how to look at a story, the feel of a story, the beginning, middle, and end, when you build. I mean, and many people use those structures, you know, as the basis of their stories. Jeff Zimmerman teaches with,
yes,
you know, that kind, in that way, the hero's journey.
Yeah, because that's one of the oldest stories of all mankind.
Yeah.
That's what Lord of the Rings is. Lord of the Rings is a hero's journey. It's a quest.
Well, a lot of stories are.
Like, how long have you been doing stories?
I was trying to figure it out. Maybe about 28 years, 27 years.
Okay, so like
and that was
from 1990.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I kind of fell into it. I was an actress before.
Ah, okay.
I was an actress and a director, and I was a writer, and I would work with kids and write plays based on what they did or what they, you know, either what they made up. It was fun.
Oh, cool. Well, we'll get back to that in a minute. But what I want to know is, you're not a native New Yorker, but you're East Coast, correct?
I'm East Coast. I grew up on the Jersey Shore.
Oh, Jersey Shore.
Yes, I'm the real Jersey Shore.
So
not like those people.
Would you be a Snooki? Would you be a J-Wow? Or would you be an Angelina?
None of those people.
Do you know who they are?
Yeah, none of them are represented.
Did you used to watch? Did you used to watch that show?
Oh my God!
How do you know who they are?
Because how can I avoid it? And because I watch enough of them. I mean, they're the kind of people who would come to the Jersey Shore. But people who live on the shore are different.
Yes, I know what you mean. It's like people that live out east on Long Island, like live in the Hamptons, right? Like they're the townies. And then the people that come in are the people that get their eyes rolled at and get out of here.
Oh, yeah. So it's exactly the same thing. I mean, those are the people who rent places and are annoying.
I think the storyteller Sean O'Brien is another Jersey Shore native. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I gotta meet this person.
Yeah, yeah. You should have him tell a long form story. Sean O'Brien is pretty cool.
I know Sean.
He makes his own beef jerky.
Oh, I love him already.
Oh, it's delish. Okay, so you grew up as a native Jersey Shorean. What town?
Oakhurst.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And did you come from a performer or literary type of writerly family, or did you just like get your creativity just like from chromosome 14G or something?
My family was considered the Beatties. Everybody knew us. My brother was going to be the first Jewish president.
So you were notorious.
So we were all notorious.
Awesome.
We were well loved.
Oh, like Notorious Big, Notorious Beatty.
You got like that Notorious Beatty. Oh my God. That's going to be my other name.
Oh, that is so cool.
That's a great stage name. But yeah, we were all, my younger sister is a puppeteer.
Oh, awesome.
And she's done that for her whole life. I did theater my whole life until I got involved with storytelling, and then I switched.
So did you always want to be an actor when you were young? Were you the type of kid that would do like performances in the living room and run around with a hairbrush?
Yeah, we all did.
Well, you guys.
I mean, my entire family would do that.
Oh wow! So you like your mom and dad would run around with hairbrushes?
No, but my dad, not my dad, but my mom. We put on. Well, this is I'm older than you, so we would put on records.
I know what records are.
I know, just in case. But we'd put them on and we'd sing and act.
So wait, so did your mom have aspirations to be a performer? Was she thwarted?
My mom, do you know who the group theater is?
The group theater? No.
Okay, so some people would say that the quintessential American style acting was formulated among this group of actors in New York called the group theater. Harold Clurman, Lee Strasberg, Stella Adler.
Oh, okay. I didn't know.
It's like this goes back to the 20s and the 30s. So the group theater, so when my mom was growing up, for a while they worked out of Henry, they had this beautiful theater at Henry Street Settlement, and they used that theater.
So your mom was a native New Yorker?
So my mom was a native New Yorker. Both my parents were.
Oh, okay. From where? Were they from Brooklyn?
They were, from the Lower East Side.
Oh my God.
But now we call it the East Village.
Props.
Yeah. Children of immigrants. I mean, they were both. One side of the family came from Russia. The other side came from Romania.
Wow. Romania?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
That's the wacko side.
Yeah, well, you
know. I hope you're all hearing it.
Everybody's got something about them that's wackadoo, you know.
The Russians are the nuts people, and Romanians are just artists. I mean, my family is filled with artists.
Oh.
Of all kinds.
Cool.
One of my cousins was a well-known cabaret singer.
Name?
Andrea Markovici.
That's one. She's your cousin?
Yeah.
For real?
From like.
I know who she is.
Yeah.
I've heard the name. Wow.
And painters and photographers and dancers.
So you guys were encouraged to like be wackadoo.
Yeah, we were encouraged. I went to Antioch College, for God's sake.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that had a reputation like in the 90s. I don't even know. I can't even imagine what it was like in the 70s. Oh, my God.
It was like the whole dorm would be tripping.
Wow.
Antioch is like a college full of firsts. It was the first college to integrate. It was the first college to have women along with men.
Is that true?
Yeah.
What year was that? Do you know?
A long time ago. It's in Ohio. It's the first one to do work-study programs. It's the first college to have men and women share the same dormitories.
Really?
So
what year was that?
When I was in there, it was in the 70s. When I came to Antioch, when it rained, everybody would take their clothes off in the summer and go running around in the rain.
Naked?
Oh, yeah.
Fun!
But I was going to say, the Ohio farmers used to come and watch it.
Oh, snap.
So, I mean, they would come anyway to watch the crazies. You know, I mean, Antioch, it was in this beautiful little town of Yellow Springs. It was the drug capital of the Midwest, but it was also, it was founded by Horace Mann. And, you know, what he said is, be ashamed to die before you have taken one step to improve humankind.
Huh. I've heard that saying.
Yeah, I didn't say that correctly, but.
But no, I've heard, I mean, you're probably paraphrasing it, but I've heard of that.
I mean,
Google
that. Horace Mann was an incredible man. And, you know, I mean, Antioch kind of flipped out, but I mean, it was, you know, it was a center of civil rights in Ohio, in that area. Coretta King went there. Scott King went there. All sorts of really interesting people.
Wow. I didn't realize that it had that history. I know in the 90s, it was also noted for different progressive
ideas
and the ways that people interacted with each other.
Well,
it's a long history of it.
So they're the first people who said, men and women, boys and girls, before you have sex, you have to ask.
Yes!
I mean, and people made...
Consent.
Consent, and people made fun of it.
Right.
For years, but...
Well, and
now we're doing it.
And now look what's happening today.
Yeah.
Look what's happening at the end of 2017. I just mean that it's crazy to think that, like, this idea was spawned going on 30 years ago. And, like, now it's finally come to the forefront.
Antioch, the biggest gift it gave me, well, number one, it allowed me to break free of this very small town mentality I had. We came from a very small town, number one. And number two, it allowed me to drop out. You know, it gave, the first decision I think I ever made in my life was to drop out of college. And it was the right decision. I was not mature enough. I didn't want to be there. I wanted to do theater. And that's what I did. I dropped out. And I would never even, I mean, I was the kind of girl who did what I thought I was supposed to do. It would never have occurred to me.
Well, person from your generation, that's what you did. Because,
that's what you did.
Because you, would you consider yourself a hippie?
Sort of, yeah. Kind of,
okay, so that's the generation, I mean, as a baby boomer, right?
Yeah.
That's the generation where all that stuff started changing. Because before then, it was all conformist, like 1950s stuff, right? I mean, I know.
No, it's exactly true. I mean, when I came, my friends, you know, probably did drugs and they drank a lot. And I didn't do any of that until I left for college. But in the years that after I left, it like flooded my town, my little town. And that changed.
Wow.
You know, and it was, so that was the time that everything was breaking loose.
Yes. All the student protests that went on in multiple cities. I mean, Stockholm and Amsterdam and Paris and London and here and other places, and riots all over the United States. People thought that, they must have thought that the world was going to end. Like, what was it like to be a sentient human being then, and a young person coming of age and going through that?
Well, before I went to Antioch, I didn't know most of that. I was pro-Vietnam War. I was, I wasn't politicized. I mean, I believed in peace and I believed in civil rights and everybody was equal. But I lived in a town where, you know, only the last, whatever, 20 years that they let Jews in, to say nothing about black people or anybody else.
Right. So, I mean, people sometimes forget that Jews were discriminated against a lot in early and mid-century, 20th century America.
Oh, my God. And
yeah,
still
yeah.
are.
Yeah.
My uncle gave all my cousins, and was going to give to my father, new names, so they didn't sound Jewish when they were going to the workforce.
I mean, you know, it's just a cycle, which hopefully in the next couple of years that's going to break, about hating people and discriminating against people because you're this or that or the other thing, you know. Ugh, it's just, anyway, back to art. When you got out of Antioch and you decided you wanted to be an actor.
I went to Chicago.
Went to Chicago? Okay.
That was what I did. I dropped out of college. I went to Chicago. I joined a street theater company there called Rapid Transit Guerrilla Communications.
Oh, cool.
It was cool. I have pictures I'll show you sometime. We did stuff in the streets. And then we started touring. But we did stuff about racism and sexism and... We talked about white privilege even back then.
So you were doing original plays, not like plays that had been written before.
No, we did. We wrote them ourselves.
Oh,
anti-Vietnam.
That's what I mean. Original plays.
Yeah, like, we wrote them as a group often.
Oh, cool. So it was like political.
It was all political.
Cool.
And we had a women's theater, because the women's movement. I mean, I finally discovered what the women's movement.
So this
was
in the early 70s.
This was in the early 70s. And I moved to Chicago in the winter, the coldest time you could be there. I was picked up by two people in a car that had no bottom and no heat.
You mean like a Flintstones car?
Yeah, pretty much. They picked me up. It was pretty scary. I wasn't sure what I'd gotten into.
Okay.
Yeah.
So how long did you stay in Chicago?
I stayed there 5 years, and then I came to New York to go to acting school.
Oh, what school did you go to?
I went to NYU. To the professional actor training program.
Tisch School of the Arts?
It was Tisch, but it was then the MFA program was also a BFA program, if you could get in. And
right.
I got in.
Right, because you had dropped out of Antioch, so you ended as an undergrad?
I was there as an undergrad, but they were, again, it was this particular program which became the graduate program.
Oh, okay, cool. So it was both. So you
so
just went in and you could
then.
Do both. You can
get
both.
And
okay.
I could have gotten, such the dumbest thing I ever did, I could have gotten a master's by writing one damn paper. I was afraid to write it.
Oh, I hate that. I know. We sabotage yourself in so
I
many
just
different
was
ways.
Afraid.
Okay, so NYU, and the acting program, and
then
you started trying to become an actor, like a legit actor?
Yeah, and I didn't like it.
Why?
I'll tell you the truth is I don't think I'm emotionally, I mean, this is what I look at. It's like, I'm not really set up to be an actor.
Mm.
Like, I was pretty good, I think, when I was.
Did you do any theater? Did you get any parts?
I did theater and I got parts. But, you know, I'm just like this person who, I mean, I started wanting to, like, tell people what I wanted them to do. It's like, I didn't take direction as well as I should have. Let's just put it that way. I'm not a big, if it doesn't make sense to me, it takes me a while to make it work. And
so how long did you fight this fight about, like, I'm trying to be an actor before you were just
2
like...
2 years.
Oh, that's all.
That was all.
So some people do it for like 2 decades.
Well, I mean, I will say I kept fighting it, but then I went to the 92nd Street Y and I created a youth theater project.
Oh, when was this?
This was in 79.
How did you get into it? I mean, did you just make it up, or was this an existing thing that you
got
into? I made
it up. I went over there and I said, this is my idea.
Really?
And oh, that's cool. That's my strength.
Is that one of the first programs that happened in the city?
I think I was. I'd have to look back at that. It was just fun. And I'm, like I said, one of my strengths is creating programs. Like, I like to create programs that uses not just my own abilities, but the abilities of other people.
So you would say that you're an inherent educator then?
I'm an who knew?
Yeah.
I'm an educator.
I think so.
But I'm a producer.
Yeah. But I you have a love of teaching. You have a love of imparting stuff to people. So I think that you have like that teacher DNA. That's cool.
Yeah.
I like that you just like you went after, because a lot of people just like wait for stuff to come to them.
No.
But like you just were like, I want to do this. So you did it. I think that's really cool. So when and how did you discover the storytelling?
Well, when I was at the 92nd Street Y, which was where I did it, the first theater, they kept saying, there's this storytelling woman, you got to meet her. Her name is Penina Schramm. She's like this incredible Jewish storyteller. This was in like 82.
Oh my God.
83.
Wow.
And, you know, I went, I met her. I took a class. I thought, this is the easiest thing in the world. She encouraged me, but I was not interested. And, I mean, I just thought it was not very cool. Personal stories, none of that was cool. I was involved in, you know, I was doing my youth theater, but my friends were these cool avant-garde musicians and shit, and that's what I wanted. I wanted to be cool.
So you were living in New York, were you like hanging out in the East Village or the West Village?
In the East Village.
Okay.
Yeah. But I was, but my circle was very small. It was the people, it was musicians, it was people I met, and, you know, I mean, I let go of my political theater stuff when I came to NYU, but it came back to me too. But yeah, so I did that, and then I had a vocal injury. I had vocal nodules, and I had other physical problems and issues, so I took a break.
And wow, for how long?
For about 3 years.
Wow.
It was like, and I became a secretary for 2.5. I'm still holding myself like this.
Yeah, I can see that.
It was the hardest job I ever did, and humiliating, because I was an artist. And I was the person who gave my stuff to be typed by secretaries. Best lesson I ever had in my life.
You know, sometimes life hands you a lesson that you need to learn.
Oh.
You know?
What did I learn? I learned, number one, that secretaries are the most important people.
Yeah, they know more than their boss.
They know more than their boss, and they're not paid enough.
That's correct.
Or treated well.
That's correct.
And I never would ever treat anybody like that ever again. Number two, I learned that I was unhappy.
Mm.
And I had never been unhappy working before. I hated sucking up to people. I hated having to do things the way people wanted me to.
Mm.
I didn't care if things matched, you know, I just couldn't get into it. And I found it degrading to be ordered about and blamed for things that weren't my problem. And so I discovered that being a creative person was not just a thing I could do. It was the thing I had to do.
So what got you back into it?
Well, I went to a couple full vocal therapists who helped me and gave me confidence in my voice again. And that was the big thing. And then I had started doing performing for kids. As always, I went to Barnes & Noble's, didn't know that they were looking for people to do things. But I walked in, I said, here's a plan. You don't have to pay me, but I'm going to come in for 4 weeks, and this is what I'm going to do for you. And it involved telling stories to kids.
Wow. And when was this?
Oh, God. 30 years ago. No, 28 years ago.
So like 1990, 89.
Yeah.
Wow.
So I walked in, and first thing I did was I got books. I was going to read books. This idea came from...
Well, how did you end up getting paid for it?
Oh, well, that's a long story.
All right, the encapsulated version.
Okay, so basically, I did it. I walked in. Well, the first thing is I read. I realized that was boring. So I told the story, and I thought that then the next time I brought my guitar, and then I was off to the races. How did I? Well, because I realized I found other people were getting paid, so I thought I should get paid too.
Yeah.
And I started performing for the New York Public Library, where all they paid was $50. And
well, $50 was $50.
It wasn't
back
that
then.
Much. Even back then, it wasn't.
Well, it's like $5 now. Well, anyway.
Yeah, right. I know. But anyway, and that's how I started. And then somebody told me I wasn't charging enough. And so I upped my prices. And you know, I still don't sure I charge right, whatever the fuck.
So that's how that you means. Started to make a living as a storyteller.
Right. And I mean, I've always made a living teaching art. And to me, the teaching and the performing is how I make my living as an artist.
Right.
Because the teaching fuels me. Like, you know, I mean, it's really interesting now that I'm doing stories, you know, in, you know, personal stories in adult situations. That's why I've started teaching adults telling stories. So I'm teaching them how to tell personal stories.
So let's talk about that segue a little bit. What would you say would be your entree or your segue into doing the moth type of storytelling that people know as storytelling today?
Was me? You.
Really?
You know how I tell you sometime that you're my first friend in this? You were.
I didn't realize.
And you took me to see people and you told me what to do. And you gave me courage. And
oh my God.
I mean, I'd gone to the Moth and I hadn't liked it for all the same reason a lot of my buddies and the other part of it didn't. Oh, you only do 5 minutes and it's competitive and all that. And I was convinced I was better than everybody, you know, because you're an artist, you're arrogant. But I still was holding on to that, the kind of not learning arrogance where you think you're better. But then I think when I started hanging out with you, I started seeing what people did.
For someone who came into the neo world of storytelling, kicking and screaming, haha. Now she is just such a champion of it. She has been, for the past 5 years, hosting storytelling concerts in her living room called Beatty House Story Concerts, where she will host 4 storytellers, 1 from out of town, 3 from New York, and everybody gets to do a long form thing. They get to do up to 30 minutes each. That I've been to many of these. I performed in a couple of these. Let me tell you that this living room is like freaking full to the rafters, and the performers get paid. So that is just one of the biggest blessings in the storytelling community, for us to be able to get paid to do our art. And I just like, I'm so grateful for you for doing this. You're such a go-getter.
It's fun, number one. I mean, I hate preparing and I hate cleaning up, but I like everything else.
Let's talk a little bit about theater and producing. This past summer, you got the idea to do a show in Ashenovic's Speak Up, Rise Up Festival. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, that was called No, I Won't Shut Up. Or no, wait, No, We Won't Shut Up. Well, I really liked what Asher does. I have such respect for him and such regard. He just, you know, always puts his money where his mouth is. I just thought, you know, what do I want to see? I mean, I often think this, like, if I don't see something then and I want to see it, then it's my job to make it happen. And that's how I think of it. So I knew I wanted to do women. Though there are many good one amazing storytellers who are men, I knew that with everything that's been going on, particularly with Trump, my cat has just joined us, that I wanted to do a show where women got to speak about what happened in their life that they just don't want to be quiet about anymore. So that's why I called it No, We Won't Shut Up. And I asked different women who I knew had a good story or knew were good performers.
So you have another history of doing solo performance. How did you segue from storytelling to solo performance?
I think of it as the same thing.
Oh, you okay. Well, because solo performance would be like a long form, like an hour story.
Oh, I know.
Okay.
But, you know, I do, when I do performances, mostly for children, though also for adults with folklore, you put together an hour and a half program. So I'm used to being on stage for that long. I also work with musicians. I have two fabulous musicians that I work with. So I'm used to being on stage for a long time and having to take that. And I don't know, like I said, in 1990, I was already thinking about, it was 1980s. I was thinking about doing this with my friend where it would be a solo, a duo performance, personal story thing. And I have this story that came up. And basically, it came up because I have this letter that I received. I'm not going to go, it's going to be part of my story, so you're going to hear it in the story. But this letter, let's just say it was something that anyone who knew how involved I was in radical politics would have been surprised to note that I have this letter.
So you're going to say, would it be correct to say that your radical politics have fueled your performance for your whole career so far?
Since the 80s, yes.
Wow. So
and that was the other reason I got out of theater, was like, I just thought, I don't want to do any of this stuff.
Well, a little kitty, I don't want to say little birdie because I have a kitty on me now. A little kitty says that you have a story that you're going to share for us right now. So why don't we do that?
Okay, and this is the first part of my solo show.
Oh, okay. So this is an excerpt from Robin Beatty's latest solo show, which is called
Nancy Drewinsky and the Search for the Missing Letter. When I was in fourth grade, I had an epiphany. I knew what I was going to do for the rest of my life. You see, in that class that day, we'd seen this very interesting film about an important federal agency that goes after and catches the really bad guys. I was inspired, and I wanted to be just like them. I knew that I, too, should be part of that search for truth and justice and the American way. Yes, my friend, I want to be an FBI agent. Well, it makes perfect sense. Well, you didn't know me in fourth grade, but trust me, if you knew me then, it would have made perfect sense. Number one. I am smart and determined, and you can ask anyone about that. Number two, I do well in school in all my subjects. Number three, I am great at puzzles. I love to figure things out. And number four, probably the most important thing of all, I'm intrusive. See? I've got everything. I've got the perfect skill set. I am also a self-starter, so I wrote a letter to the agency describing who I was, what I did, and what I was looking forward to doing in my future. And here's the amazing part. Not 4 weeks went by before I received a reply. Here. Let me read it to you. United States Department of Justice, Federal Bureau of Investigation, Washington 25, D.C., November 15th, 1960. Dear Robin, your letter of November 6th, 1960 has been received and it is a pleasure to hear from you. I get lots of letters from boys and girls, but I believe you are the very first one to write a poem about the FBI. Your work shows great talent, and I am pleased that you chose to write about us. Oh, that poem, it was long. It was amazing. I'll give you the first verse. Oh, to be in the FBI, looking for criminals on land, sea, and sky, searching for justice steadfastly. Why? The FBI is the place for me. Okay, I can't give you the rest. Let me read you the rest of the letter, though. It is certainly commendable for young people to take an interest in law and order, as you are doing by being a member of your school safety patrol. However, as you already know, only men can be special agents. Wait a minute. Only men can be special agents for the FBI. However, we do have many excellent positions available to women, such as secretary and file clerk. And I am enclosing an article which contains information in greater detail concerning those jobs. Oh, here's the cool part. Very sincerely yours, Jay. I mean it. Edgar. I hope you're impressed. Hoover! J. Edgar Hoover! For real! He wrote me! He's the legendary director of the FBI. He founded the modern FBI, and he wrote me. I was so impressed by myself. And then that second part of the letter came back to me. What was he talking about? Women not being agents? Why not? That wasn't fair. And how could that be? I mean, didn't he know about that teenage girl who solved mysteries effortlessly with the help of her faithful friends, Bess and George, and her boyfriend, that good-looking Ned? I had read and reread every book in the series. Everybody respected her. I mean, didn't he know about Nancy Drew? Well, I was disappointed, but not discouraged, because deep in my heart, I knew that this was not the end, that someday, somehow, somewhere, I too would use my skills and, like Nancy, I would uncover a mystery that needs me to solve it.
That's awesome. Oh my God. Thank you. I can't wait to see the whole thing.
It's pretty intense.
You're
going to
be doing it again in 2018, right?
I don't know where, but yes.
Okay. Yeah. Well, we're almost at the end of 2017 here. So we have to think ahead.
I'm going to be in a couple fringes. I know that.
Oh, that's great.
Maybe
okay.
The Philadelphia fringe, if I can figure out, and the Indy fringe. And I'm just starting to apply to fringes. I love it. I had 4 shows and each one, the story changed.
Well, of course
just
it does.
Just a little.
Of course, I was shocked.
Well, it morphs. At how much.
It morphs. It morphs. It's a living thing.
It was amazing.
When you create a solo show, when you create any story, to me, it's a living thing. It's not static. It's not dead. It's a living thing. So it always evolves and grows. And that's one of the reasons why I love storytelling.
Mm.
Because it's a living art. Yes, that's what it is. It's a living art. So, if people want to follow you or learn more about your fabulousness and your Beatty House concerts, how can they find you?
They should go on Facebook and look for Beatty House Storytelling Concert. I think it's concert. And find the page. You can find me on Facebook also. I have a website for Nancy Drewinsky. It's nancydrewinsky.com.
Great.
And I'll be posting that. And I have a website that I just have not gotten around to updating, But you can see what I do in terms of folklore.
Is that RobinBeatty.com?
RobinBeatty.com.
Are you on Twitter and IG?
I'm on Twitter and Instagram now.
Okay. All right. In closing, I always ask this question of everybody. Like, I always open with, like, how do we meet? So this is a question that I ask everybody at the end of the interview. So if you could say one thing to the child sitting alone in thought in their bedroom, on the dock of the bay, daydreaming out the window in their classroom, doing their chores, who really wants to be an artist, they aspire, but people all around them are telling them that's not what they should expect to do. What would you tell them?
Follow your own voice. Listen to your own voice. And just do it. Just do it. You know, there's nothing, what I keep learning over and over again, there's nothing more important than listening to myself and then making it happen. So there's two parts. One is the dream, and then the second part is the work.
From the mouth of a go-getter.
Yeah.
And a life worth living and examining. Thank you, Robin, for being a fish out of water. Hug in the air.
I love you.
We haven't worked this one up, but we don't care. Riding on the city of New Orleans. Illinois Central Monday morning rain. 15 cars and 15 restless riders. 3 conductors and 25 sacks of mail. Out on a southbound odyssey, the train pulls out of Kankakee and rolls past houses and farms of beef. Ass and towns that have no name, and freight yards full of old black men, and the graveyards of the rusted automobile. Just a saying good morning, America, how are ya? Hey, don't you know me, I'm your native son. I'm the train they call the city of New Orleans. I'll be gone 500 miles when day is done. Dealing cards with the old men in the club car. It's many a point, ain't nobody keeping score. Pass that paper bag that holds a bottle. Feel the wheels crumbling beneath the floor. And the sons of Pullman porters and the sons of engineers ride their daddy's magic carpet made of steam. And mothers with the babes asleep go rocking to the gentle beat and the rhythm of the rails. Oh, they dream, singing good morning, America, how are you? Hey, don't you know me, I'm your native son. I'm the train they call the city of New Orleans. I'll be going 500 miles when day is done. Time on the city of New Orleans. We're changing cars in Memphis, Tennessee. It's halfway home and we'll be there by morning. Through the Mississippi darkness roll into the sea. But all the towns and people seem to fade into a bad dream. And the steel rail still ain't heard the news. The conductor sings that song again. It's passengers, oh please refrain it. This train has got the disappearing railroad blues. Just a saying goodnight, America, how are you? Hey, don't you know me? I'm medicine. I'm the train they call the city of New Orleans. I'll be gone 500 miles when day is done. Just a singing good night, America, how are ya? Hey, don't you know me, I'm your native son. I'm the train they call the city of New Orleans. And I'll be gone a long, long time when day is done.
We appreciate it, folks. Thank you.
Can we teach you one? This is a...
And we're back with Fish Out of Agua on Radio Free Brooklyn. That song was City of New Orleans by folk singer Steve Goodman from the Judith album in 1975. Another of Robin's picks for this episode. Yeah, folky, stories, politics. Boy, that's some life Robin's had, and I'm so glad that she's telling stories. The next Beatty House concert, be on the lookout for it in 2018. Well, kids, you know what time it is now. That's our show. You have been listening to Fish Out of Agua on Radio Free Brooklyn. If you like this show or any other of the fine shows on Radio Free Brooklyn, consider sponsoring us. Just go to RadioFreeBrooklyn.com, click on the Donate tab, and do what it says. Support living artists. Yes, that is a good thing. Okay, so we're going to close with Sarah Vaughan, Just One of Those Things, from the compilation album in 1992, the last of Robin's picks. And stay tuned for Brooklyn Bandstand next. And we'll see you next week. Woohoo!
Trip to the moon on gossamer wings, just one of those things.